Welcome to Web Talk Radio again at webtalkradio.com for June 5th, 2006. And my name is Rob Greenlee, and I'm joined again by Dana Greenlee in here.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Hey, it's June, Rob. It's summertime already.
Oh, and I also want to mention you've got the Boston Legal Podcast, too, out there. Even though you're on, like, summer hiatus, that's the proper term for it.
Yeah.
But still, there's a bunch of good shows there. Go check out Dana's podcast.
Well, we've got a lot of interesting topics to cover today. One of them is a little scary, Rob.
Yes, it is. Is the USA Big Brother looking over our shoulder into our browsers?
And even though they are, or maybe planning to, still at-home web use is on the rise.
And would you want a mobile phone web server? That's the question.
And Tim wrote us. We want to read his email on the air.
I don't know, about 15 minutes from now, we're going to be joined by Blake Ross, who's the author and co-founder of the Mozilla Foundation's Firefox web browser, the popular one that's really grown online, and has actually forced Microsoft to really upgrade its old IE6 browser. Blake has a new book called Firefox for Dummies, and he's going to tell us a whole story on the founding of Firefox and how it got its cool name.
I go into a lot of things that I don't think a lot of people understand about Firefox, the naming history, why it's called Firefox, why, for example, the tabbed browsing feature, which everyone loves, is so hidden throughout the product and why you kind of have to pull it out. Just a bunch of different little anecdotes from the early days of Firefox development that a lot of people don't know.
If you want to give us your opinions on the show or topics you want to talk about or just want to chat with us, you can reach us at rob@webtalkradio.com and dana@webtalkradio.com. And we definitely want you to let us know what you're thinking.
Yeah, we appreciate you tuning into the show. It's great. And we're proud members of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. And the network has some great tech podcasts. They're actually adding some new ones all the time. And you can also get this show, Web Talk, on your phone at Melodio's Mobilecast at mobilecast.com. Just drop the E from mobile and you can get right to there. And also, Mobilecast has a new website coming that you can join the review beta on that. It's at melodio.com. Just go visit the website, drop your email address in there, and you'll get an email in a couple weeks to get a sneak preview of this cool new podcasting website. It's really
good.
Cool.
Yeah, he's working hard on it. Rob, actually, let me interject here before we get in talking about our attorney general and his meetings with AOL.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to relate quickly what happened to me a few weeks ago, but I think I wanted to share it when next time we did a show because I think it's a really cool piece of software that really saved me a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not an ad or anything because I'm not getting anything for it. But I do a lot of streaming on my site, and I do a lot of video archiving on this Boston Legal website because mm-hmm. it's about a television show. And I've always kind of found it very difficult to get access to some video that I want to be able to, maybe even, put on my server and then keep for sort of posterity and archival. But it only streams maybe at abc.com or someplace like that.
Yeah, so you're talking about recording streams.
Yeah.
So video streams.
Recording video streams. And yes, I know it's probably not my right to do that, but maybe I want to just archive it for my own personal use or something. So I've tried a lot of, I've gone to download.com, tried a little softwares here and there, and nothing quite works. And then I found a Replay AV, which is mm-hmm. It's the name of some software you just downloaded on the internet. And it worked so well that, and I've just been crazy about it. I've been using it. I've been finding things to record all over the place so I can keep a copy because these streaming sites disappear or, there'll be something up. In fact, there was a Boston Legal panel discussion in New York City a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually, if you couldn't attend in person, they actually streamed it live.
Mm-hmm.
And I captured it. And it was great because then I obviously can't go to New York and oftentimes, I'm not there to be able to watch it live. And so, anyway, it really helps. So, if you want to try it, if you ever want to do something like that, Replay AV, and it's, you can actually do a Google search for Replay AV, but it's at applian.com. It's applian.com. And they have a free demo, which is what I did. I use the free service, and it records a certain number of megabytes mm-hmm. or 3 minutes, whatever comes first. So you can get an example of how it works, and you can do that indefinitely. But if you want to buy it, it's like, I can't remember, it's like $35
Yeah, I think it's like $30 or whatever. The company that makes this software that you're talking about is the same one that makes Replay Radio, which mm-hmm. is the radio station kind of live streaming recording software.
I use that all the time. Oh,
which
man.
We've talked about that software program quite a bit on the show over the years, because so it's been one of the leading. Well, actually, they were doing some podcasting distribution from the software. Actually, even before podcasting started, they actually had this software program that would initiate the download of the MP3 from a person's website. Before there was ever podcasting, so it was actually kind of a cool.
That it kind of beat the crest of the wave.
And I don't think that they've really gotten a lot of credit for that that piece of the functionality of their software as far as recognition in the podcasting space for kind of being one of the first.
Mm. I use their Replay Music a lot. But anyway, if you get Replay AV, it actually has the ability to also just capture streaming audio, too.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to necessarily have Replay Radio or Replay Music. You can just get Replay AV and do audio and video. And it captures QuickTime or Windows Media, or it doesn't matter what format. And
you can just rip off anything and everything.
Yeah. And you can save it to different formats. And the audio you can save to all different kinds of audio formats. I know.
Yeah, it's one of those gray area issues that
I'm not going to get sued for saying this. I don't know. I don't think they've even been sued. So
no.
You know.
It fits within kind of a gray area of the Millennium Copyright Act. It's really a software program for personal use, and that's how most people use it. It's kind of like a TiVo. I mean, it enables you to record,
time shift your audio or TV
content. So that's kind of where it kind of skirts some of that legal copyright issue. But but if a person records that and then redistributes it for commercial gain, then obviously you get into that whole copyright area. That's not a good thing to do,
I suppose.
But Dana, it appears that the Bush administration that's here in the United States, the president of the United States and his attorney general are plotting to keep an eye on all of our browsers.
Plotting. You make it sound like it's a
conspiracy.
A conspiracy.
Yeah, no. But, it's really kind of a concerning thing for all of us here in the United States because, you know, we don't want to have people looking over our shoulders into our browsers and tracking all that stuff and having that information go to the government. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I have nothing to hide,
Dana?
But I've always said that. They can look whatever they want to. They can listen to my phone conversations.
Well, they're already doing that, so, yeah.
But let's just be clear about it. What happened last week was that Alberto Gonzalez, who's our attorney general, met with people, not to be confused with Al and Shore, met with a lot of people from AOL and Comcast, Google and Microsoft and Verizon. And they are mainly doing this as like an anti-terrorism effort. But all they're asking, Rob, Mr. Conspiracy Theory, is that these companies please keep their log files for
a couple years. Just store that information.
Them.
It isn't like they're transmitting. As far as we know, they're not transmitting it to the government.
So I don't know this. I suspect it's like a case-by-case basis. So we have this Mohammed guy, or I shouldn't even assign a name to it. We have this individual that may be a terrorist, and
he's under prosecution or
so they probably still have to go get the court order and everything
exactly.
And say, AOL, can we see his activity, pull the log files in the last 2 years? And I'm not sure exactly what they'd find because I don't think any self-respecting terrorist is going to go use Google and surf over.
Yeah,
to
I mean,
Bin Laden's.
What are they going to do? Go over and visit, like a website in, Iraq or in Afghanistan or something like that somehow has some linkage to terrorism, which I suppose is possible. I would think that the big thing they would want to track would be the emails and the instant messenger conversations. To be able to get actual information. Because where a person goes on the web, I mean, unless they're somehow able to track communications that way, which I know a lot of communications is becoming web-based.
Gmail.
Gmail. And actually, even Gmail has, an instant messenger function now. So maybe there is some piece of this. But it's a little disconcerting to me to know that our government's getting into this kind of penetration of information and tracking everything that we're doing. It's like the whole purpose of the internet was to increase communication and reaching, be able to reach people and kind of eliminate distance from people to make a better world. But it seems like what's happening is that it's opened this huge door to the government to peek in on all of our personal lives.
Remember, they're not peeking in on it, and only if you're a baddie already.
That's, well, supposedly. That's where that's what we're being told.
But I guess it's not just America. If I understand this story correctly, it says if the European Union's approach were adopted. So this is not, you know, if the European Union, if we follow their recommendation, they're the ones that are asking the internet companies to save logs from your email and instant messaging. Whereas good old Al only said, hey, Google, save your log files. And that's maybe a little different than what, so it's maybe even more conservative than what the European Union is asking.
Yeah, but that's one step towards, okay, Google, just hand it over once a month, you know. I just don't, you know, it's hard to trust.
What have you got to hide?
Yeah, well, I don't have anything
to hide.
I just think there's a lot of people that probably are concerned about, you know.
Well, I think they were Gonzalez actually brought this up earlier in regards to child exploitation, I guess, looking up the pedophile habits. And, you know, of course, they're using, I think you made a good point just before we started recording, says they're using these trigger buttons. You know, everybody says, oh, anything we can do to stop pedophiles, things that make people emotional and willing to let go of their rights.
Scare them good. And that's exactly what this is.
And then they open up the door for the others.
Yeah. So if they can create this path
terrorism.
Of what they want to get, what information they want to get, then they start creating these lists of justifications for doing it, whether or not it's legitimate or not.
Okay, you're not referring to anything like WMDs.
Well, there seems to be some correlation between how our government gathers information about us and then how they justify it afterwards, and it seems to be a moving target. So anyway, you know, my political views are coming out a little bit, but I think, you know, most online users can sympathize with this, and most people don't have anything to be afraid of because they have nothing to hide. But it's still concerning.
If this happens, then our next story actually might see a U-turn in its statistics. And the next story is about people surfing at home. More and more people, obviously, but this is, we have statistics to prove it, are now surfing the internet at home as opposed to work or office or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so I'm saying they may not want to now that they've realized that Al is going to start collecting their stuff.
Well, it's the at-home surfing piece is still growing, where the at-work piece is actually kind of stabilized, and it may actually, to a certain extent, may actually decline.
Seems like. Because more people do it at home because it's safer. They're not going to get monitored by their boss.
Well, exactly. Some employers are starting to realize that letting their employees surf the internet unlimited at work can actually cut into productivity and can be a distraction for people. And I think that there's been concern for a long time about email doing that as well. So anyway, the numbers are continuing to go up for people using the internet. It's up 5% over last year, up to an estimated 172 million online users in the United States.
How many people currently in the United States?
I think there's like 280.
Oh, 80.
No, yeah, I think it's about 280 million.
Okay. So and this is 170.
Well, it's 77% is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Is 172 million.
I could do the math, I suppose. No, I can't. Who am I kidding?
And that's up from 57% back in 2000. Back when we started doing this show, approximately, it was only about 57% of the U.S. population was online. Now it's up to 77%.
You know what I don't see statistics for anymore is the ratio of men to women. I think it's fairly equal now. Remember we used to count?
It's more women are online now than men.
Remember when we first started in 99, we were actually counting every time the statistic changed. Women were far less. Far less.
Well, there's more women in the general population than men, too.
Yeah.
So it's really only mirroring what the population numbers actually are showing.
9% of the U.S. were actually online in 95.
Yeah, it's a big jump, isn't it?
But in 95, I know there's always people saying, oh, I was online in 95. I think it's kind of like what you just say now. But I remember that was probably the year we got it at the university. You know, universities were the first ones with the Gopher and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, besides government. And it's, I guess maybe the 9% were mostly academics and students.
Exactly. Well, in 5 years, from 1995 to 2000, it went from 9% to 57%. That's meteoric growth. I mean, that's really fast growth. And it seems to have slowed a little bit, going from 57 to 77 in the same, approximately the same time span.
Mm.
So it's slowing a little bit. And I'm not sure that I've ever heard any expert or statistician say that it was ever going to get much over probably 80% actual penetration. Because
there's always going to be people that won't?
Well, there's always been this, what's been termed this digital divide. between people that are financially able to afford getting online and people that, or people that just don't have an interest in getting online.
Yeah, no interest. I mean, there's still people that don't watch television.
Yeah. But those numbers are dwindling, no question about it. And it's probably a generational thing, too. I think that those numbers are reflective of the older population. And it's kind of, you know, it's going to be interesting to see as the population grows older over the years, how that number is going to be affected, whether it's going to stabilize or not.
The how much we did, the whatever percentage it was we did just in 1 year, think about all the kids that moved out of their families' houses and started their own homes and went online. That could account for that in 1 year, you know, all the people that started new families.
Hey, Dana, the next story here, which is kind of fun in a way because, and we've talked about this too, you know, these miniature web servers. I think we did a story on this a couple of years ago where somebody inserted a web server into a fly.
Yeah.
And this fly could fly around and could, you know,
serve
websites from the belly of a fly. But anyway, this story is about having a mobile phone be a web server.
And I love it because Rob is always like, I have to go to the web server. I have to do it between 9 and 5 p.m. I have to drive to Seattle, pay for the parking, get in the building before they close it. Where, you know, and it's like, oh, well, now you're going to have your server with you.
It's always in my pocket. But there's a pretty legitimate company that's been playing around with this, and it's Nokia, which is the largest manufacturer of mobile phones. Mm. They actually have come out with a version of it for their Symbian operating system called, it's the Apache web server, which is actually a very popular web server on the web today with the major host providers out there.
So there's enough processing power within a phone and enough storage?
That's the funny angle about this is that that's what Nokia said was the justification for doing this, is that a lot of the new mobile phones that they're starting to produce now have more processing power than what was in some of the early web servers for the web.
Remember when we were first going to buy our first web server, we were looking at Silicon Graphics?
Yeah.
And this was like in the late 90s.
Yeah, it was like $10,000 or something.
No,
like
I thought
that.
It was like 20 or something.
No,
I think
it was about $10,000 for just a basic like 2U server, and it was probably no more powerful than my pocket PC.
So glad we didn't get stuck with that.
The phone that they've been playing around with is the Nokia 6630. And what they were initially thinking with this web server is that what they could do is enable the setup and configuration of the phone could happen via your computer through a Bluetooth transmission. So you could basically log into your phone through the Bluetooth connection on your PC.
Well, why wouldn't you just use your phone? I mean,
because it's a bigger screen.
Oh, okay.
You know, you can read more. You can actually get more detailed configurational information than trying to navigate that little tiny screen.
So why would you even have it on your phone then if it was a hassle to use, you know, and the screen size was small? Why would you have your serve web pages or images or something from your phone?
Well, it means that you could create content. You could host your web page right on the phone. And always be able to have access to updating it and changing it.
I guess that's it. And if you don't have an alternative server somewhere, then, you know, that's...
Well, and as we all get faster wireless internet access, it becomes something that, you know, may be possible. Now, there was a lot of people talking about it, and we talked about it a lot on this show in the earlier days of the web, about how we'd all have web servers in our homes, and we could serve our own content. I guess from that angle, I would have to question whether or not this is going to catch any legs, because that never happened. What would make the phone experience something more compelling that would drive that web server usage in the mobile phone? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that the wireless carriers probably are not going to be all that hot on
a lot of traffic.
You know, a significant traffic web server being hosted on their network.
Yeah. Slash dot on the phone.
Well, yeah. I mean, just think about your website that you have for boston-legal.org being hosted on your mobile phone. Is that, I mean, is that something that you would really do? I'm not sure that you would want to from a reliability standpoint and being able to really kind of give a good experience to the user now. But if you wanted to put up a website that maybe was only accessible to your friends or to your family, that maybe had pictures or had personal contact resources or something like that that could be served through your phone, and they could do the same thing, and you guys, you know.
It probably wouldn't make any difference as far as being on your phone, keeping hackers and stuff off. You know, it's still, they still access it the same way they'd access your server somewhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's not going to be an advantage.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is really going to catch any traction out there. I think it's a little too early to...
We're all about the speculation.
...to actually tell. But Nokia named this project Raccoon, which is a cool name. Dana and I really like raccoons, so we appreciate that.
We just saw Over the Hedge at the movies yesterday. I love that
raccoon.
Oh, you
had to admit that on the show, didn't you?
Bruce Willis was the raccoon. Yeah, William Shatner was the possum, and that's my favorite.
Yeah, I think the theater was full of kids. I think we were one of the few adults that actually was in the theater.
I was laughing louder than anybody. I was laughing, and no one else in the theater was laughing. So I have a simple sense of humor.
So anyway, we got an email, didn't we, Dana?
Yes, Tim Sally wrote us. Or Sally Tim. No, it's Tim Sally. I was familiarizing myself with my T-Mobile MDA phone.
And that's a Windows Mobile smartphone.
Oh, very good. Oh, Tim has the good stuff. He says, I came across your webcast radio show, and I like your radio show very much.
Yes.
Aw, Tim, and it's been a while since we received that kind of good feedback.
Well,
thank
and
you.
I think he found us on the probably on the Windows Media mobile page, probably.
Are we still on there? Not that many things are up there, are there, on the mobile page?
There used to be the Sync and Go, which used to make us available through that. But no, we're still part of the Windows Mobile media
directory thing
site that's online that mobile users can get at that will stream our show.
Yeah,
so that's where he found us. Good. Well, we've got a guest coming up on the show next here that's
an
a really interesting
person.
Guy.
Oh, amazing.
Young guy, I should say.
Very.
And on the line right now, we're joined by Blake Ross, who's the author and co-founder of the Firefox web browser, which is really cool. And he's also a new author of a book called Firefox for Dummies. He's going to tell us about the whole Firefox story. Blake, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me on, Rob.
I read about you in your book, and I guess you started working back with Netscape quite a few years ago. Why don't you give us a rundown on what motivated you to create Firefox, you know, based on your experience working at Netscape, and how the project kind of got started?
So I started working at Netscape, or really on the Mozilla project before that, back when I was 14. Because Netscape is based on this open source project, I was working closely with a lot of engineers at Netscape, and they kind of liked the work I was doing and offered me an internship for the summer. I'm not sure they realized how old I was at that point. I said I was a student. I think they might have thought college student, but it became pretty clear when I got out there and, you know, my mother was dropping me off at work every day that kind of a different situation. Worked at Netscape for, I guess it was 2 or 3 summers out here in Mountain View, California. To be honest with you, I mean, the first summer was a great experience, great first job. Couldn't ask for a better first job for someone my age. But it kind of went downhill from there. I was at Netscape after the AOL takeover, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so if you've ever talked to someone who was at Netscape kind of in the golden period, it's a very different time back then. And so when I was there, it was managed by AOL. Netscape.com was kind of the focus of the company, you know, this portal. And the browser is really at this point just a vehicle for driving traffic to the Netscape.com portal. And so we were trying very hard in this company that was driven by this Netscape.com portal to make a solid end-user browser, to make something that my mother could configure very easily, get on the web, get her work done without having to think about browser settings and viruses and that sort of thing. It was very hard to realize that vision inside Netscape because everything was about Netscape.com and everything was ultimately about the bottom line. And so it's kind of strange. A lot of people think that Firefox was some kind of attack on IE. All right, you know, in Microsoft, it was really just a response to our frustration trying to get the product that we wanted to make made inside of Netscape. And so a couple of guys and myself started to kind of work nights at Netscape on this separate fork of the code base called Firefox, or it was called Phoenix at that point. And the goal of the product, like I said, was just to make something so easy to use that my mother could set it up and never have to worry about configuring it, or about any of the other hassles that existed on the web at that point.
So do you have any challenges with the people that you're working with about being able to use that source code that was part of the, you know, a browser that they were trying to sell at that time?
Right. Right. Well, I mean, that's the beauty of open source. The whole model is based on the idea that if you don't like the direction that the product is going, you can, you know, do what's called forking the code, just basically make a copy of the code and go off in your own direction. And so we started doing that separately from Netscape. Again, we did this at night, so we were working on the core Netscape product during the day. It kind of became clear over time that we were going in a pretty good direction. We were getting good reviews. We had managed to boost the performance of the product a lot by stripping away a lot of the unnecessary features that existed inside of Netscape. And we actually went back and offered Firefox to Netscape and suggested that they start shipping a product based on Firefox, and they declined at that point. So as it turns out now, they're actually putting out Netscape 8, which is based on Firefox, so it's kind of gone full circle.
So how did this Firefox project kind of break away from the Netscape project? Was that a buy-in from some manager at the Netscape corporate office that said, go ahead, you guys, take the code base, go off in this direction? Or
no, it was a lot more informal, I guess a lot more kind of skunk works than that. So there was kind of a group of us inside of Netscape, like I said, they were kind of disillusioned with the direction of the company and with the loss of focus on users. And so, you know, we spent a lot of our time at the beginning just kind of going to Denny's and blowing off steam and, you know, meeting online and going to people's houses and just kind of doing a lot of complaining. And one day we decided that it's time to stop complaining and time to actually start making a product. You know, and that's the beauty of open source, like I said, is that we could do that. So it wasn't buy-in from Netscape. It was basically just, you know, after hours and in our spare time, just get this thing done.
So how far into the process did you guys have to go before Netscape actually bought into what you were doing?
Well, I mean, they never really bought into it. They kept going with their own line of products, the Netscape 6 and 7 suites, which were kind of the whole kitchen sink, email, and the web composer, and all that stuff. And I'm sure you recall that those were not very well received by the public or by the critics. And then at that point, Netscape basically decided to exit the browser market, and that's when they spun off Mozilla into a separate organization. AOL gave them, I think, a $2 million seed grant to get the organization going. And at that point, Netscape kind of said, you know, we're done except for maintenance releases.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's move on and talk a little about the book here, the Firefox for Dummies book that you've just written and put out there. I'm sure that the book is, you know, talks about features and how to do things in the browser. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what the intent of the book is? What were you trying to accomplish with the book?
Like you said, again, the book is Firefox for Dummies. Mm-hmm. And my intent in writing the book, there's a lot of books about Firefox on the market already, and they do a very good job of, you know, walking through the product and showing how to use it. My intent in writing the book was not just to give kind of the how of the product, but the why of the product. Mm-hmm. Because I can't tell you how many times just my mother alone and other people as well have asked me, you know, why would someone design a piece of software to work like this? You know, they run into some kind of crash in Microsoft Word or some kind of feature that doesn't work quite right. And they just want to know, you know, what was the intent here? What was the philosophy behind this feature? And because I was part of the team that helped design the Firefox interface, the book is able to go into a lot of depth about why we made the decisions that we made early on. And I think that leads to a greater understanding of the product when you know kind of our design rationale behind everything.
Okay. So that really, you know, by sharing that, that helps the user kind of understand why things are done the way they are in the context of actually using it?
Yeah, exactly. If you understand why we placed things where we did and why we designed features the way we did, I think it starts to make a lot more sense and you can get a lot more out of the product that way. So I think that's something that I could offer that a lot of other authors couldn't, and that's why I decided to write this book.
What kind of things are in the book that kind of make it different in that way? I mean, what kind of little pieces of information are you giving, like storylines of why this feature got added, or what's going on in the book?
So the book begins with kind of history of the project, which I don't think a lot of regular people would know. Like I said, it's kind of very twisted. It goes from Netscape to Mozilla, back to Netscape, Firefox, AOL, a lot of companies involved, a lot of people involved, and I think it's kind of an interesting story. It goes into a lot of history, and then I go into a lot of things that I don't think a lot of people understand about Firefox, the naming history, why it's called Firefox, why, for example, the tabbed browsing feature, which everyone loves, is so hidden throughout the product and why you kind of have to pull it out. Just a bunch of different little anecdotes from the early days of Firefox development that a lot of people don't know.
Speaking of the name, why don't you give us a quick story on and how you did come up with the name? Because it's a cool, friendly, fun name.
Yeah. I'm working on a new company right now. I'm trying my hardest to find something that's nearly as cool as Firefox. I'm so happy with the name that we've got.
Oh, yeah.
So let's see. The company, I'm sorry, the product is originally called Mozilla Flash Browser. And that was named after the source code directory that the product lived in. And we were not exactly the most ingenious marketers at that point. And we quickly realized that that was not going to fly. So we rechristened the product Phoenix. And the idea there is that, you know, this product is being reborn from the ashes of Netscape.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a not-so-subtle jab at our parent company at that point.
Yeah.
Turns out Phoenix was taken by a company called Phoenix. And we didn't have any lawyers at that point, didn't have any money, didn't really have any intent to actually productize this little hobby we're working on. So mm-hmm. we were happy to change the name at that point. It's just a question of what. And so we came up with the name Firebird because it kind of evokes the same imagery, of course, as the Phoenix, that mythical bird that is reborn from its own ashes. So we had Firebird for a little while and quickly found out that there was a trademark violation with that name as well. So we renamed it to Firebird and evoked the same imagery as the Phoenix, and it turns out there was a trademark violation with that name as well. This time it was even worse because it was an open source company called Firebird SQL. And so at that point, we decided it was time to give up on the whole Phoenix imagery. We just wanted something that had the word fire in it because Firebird was kind of well known at that point. And mm-hmm. so we spent a couple of months just kind of going back and forth saying Fireblast, Firebox, Firebomb, you know, Fire Towel, Fire, what can we do that has the word fire in it? Someone came up with Firefox. One of our amazing volunteer designers came up with the great logo that we've got now, and the name just kind of stuck at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good name here. There's no question about that. But why don't you tell us a bit about why you think that the browser has been adopted so widely and so fast here over the last few years? It just seems like you guys made this browser and it seemed to come along at just the perfect timing because right. of what's happening with the IE browser or what wasn't happening with the IE browser. But is there other things that you think factored into that? Was it a marketing that you guys did, or was it just the grassroots aspects of this thing?
So it was the grassroots aspect of it, I think, that's most responsible mm-hmm. for the spread of the product. But a lot of people kind of think that just kind of came together, which makes sense given the meaning of grassroots. The truth is that we actually tried very, very hard in the early days, and even today, to kind of help that grassroots effort form.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you could say it wasn't entirely grassroots. We certainly pushed it along. And we did that through an effort called Spread Firefox.
Mm-hmm.
The website is at spreadfirefox.com. This is something that Asa Dotzler, myself, and a few others at Mozilla started up in 2004. And the idea there is that we realized that we had a huge community of people who were not developers, who weren't really interested in testing the product, but who were passionate about the product. And in most of their open source projects that we looked at, those kinds of people were not really welcome. You know, if you're not a developer, if you're not a tester,
mm-hmm.
you don't really have a seat at the table. There's not really anything for you to do in a lot of other open source projects. And that just didn't really make sense to us.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to find a way to leverage the talents of all these people, leverage the fact that all these people have a certain set of skills, and just find a way for them to help the product out in some way. And so Spread Firefox was designed to bring all these people together, give them the tools they need to spread Firefox, and just have them go out and do that. Go to your Toastmaster club, go to your university, go to your parents' friends and their parents' businesses, and just spread the word as far and wide as you can. And Spread Firefox is actually responsible for something like, 20 million downloads
wow.
In the first 6 months of Firefox. So that was a huge, huge driver.
I would imagine, especially if it inspired that many downloads. How many downloads has Firefox had so far? Do you have a number today?
We've got a ticking counter on Spread Firefox. I think it's probably sitting at around 170 million right now. You know, obviously that includes different versions and stuff, so it's very hard to say just raw numbers We know that our market percentage is somewhere between about 12 and 15% globally at this point.
So has that been growing over the last few months, or is it stabilized?
Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty constant growth over time.
Microsoft's coming out with their IE7. Is going to, you think, put a dent in your adoption curve, or do you see them as really a non-competitive browser at this point?
I think it's a very competitive browser. I've tried IE7, their betas that they put out. It's a good browser. They've certainly made a lot of strides since IE6. To me, it's really a question of commitment. You know, if you look at the browser landscape in the past 6 years, essentially you had Microsoft disappear for four of those.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, in 2001, they completely disbanded the Internet Explorer team.
Mm-hmm.
So never mind that, you know, pop-up ads had taken over and spyware and viruses and all the kind of junk that was infecting the web at that point. Microsoft won the browser war and then effectively exited the market.
Well, yeah, because they weren't making any money on it, and
exactly.
There wasn't any competition.
You have a monopoly product, and it's a free product, and there's really no justification for a public company to be spending resources on that.
Correct.
So, you know, yes, they're back in the game right now, and you can bet that that's because we're pushing them back in the game. But I have to question their commitment to the space and whether or not they're really going to be here in another 3 years pushing the web forward. So it's kind of a question of, do you want to use a product by a company who, in the past, kind of left you hanging?
Yeah. Well, certainly with the fast growth of the Firefox browser, they're probably going to be paying more attention to it moving forward. It's just that when there wasn't any other alternative out there, they forgot about
it. Well, it's also kind of a different world. I mean, in the past, obviously they've fought this battle once before with Netscape.
Yeah.
A few different factors this time around. The first is that it's no longer that difficult to download a 5 megabyte piece of software, which is what Firefox is.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, in the Netscape days, it was kind of a much bigger deal that Microsoft became pre-installed on the Windows operating system.
Plus, as I recall, the Netscape browser was more like in the 20 megabytes, wasn't it?
Exactly. It was much larger. You know, it was still kind of the box software days at that point. The fact that Internet Explorer was installed by default, that was huge. Whereas today, that's kind of not that big of a deal.
Sure.
And I think the second issue is, I mean, this is kind of the most fascinating part, as far as I'm concerned, as I watch Microsoft respond to Firefox, is that they're trying to respond, they're trying to copy not just Firefox's features, which is expected, and we've done the same thing with other browser vendors. It's what you do when you're competing.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also trying to kind of copy Firefox's sense of openness. I think they've looked at the situation and decided that Firefox is popular not just because of the product, but because people appreciate that it's open source, that it's developed by a community of volunteers, that, you know, our communications are very open. You can go see our roadmap. You can submit your own ideas. And so in response, Microsoft, probably for the first time ever, has set up its own Internet Explorer team blog. They've got an open bug tracking database now. They've got monthly chats with the team.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that's great if I could feel that it was legitimate, but I feel like it's all just a bunch of people in a room with a whiteboard saying, how do we respond to this whole idea of open source?
Well, that's exactly what it is.
I mean, that feels kind of sleazy to me. You know, I don't want to communicate with someone who's just there for marketing reasons.
Yeah. Well, they're I think, building this browser to take back the market share that you guys are stealing from them, and if they can take advantage of some of the things that you guys have done to build that share, then they're going to do it.
But I think people can tell the difference between a genuine community.
Oh, there's no question. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that they will never have the cool factor of an open source development project because they're not.
Right.
That's
right.
For sure. Now, I know you kind of addressed this a little bit earlier on in our conversation, but having Firefox kind of take some market share away from Microsoft, does it feel inside of you as something that's almost like, you know, we actually got back at Microsoft and forced a change here based on what you went through when you were working at Netscape years ago, that they kind of came in and did some wrong things in this space?
I mean, to be honest with you, like I said, this has never really been about vengeance. I'd really have trouble waking up every day just being motivated by a desire to crush Microsoft. It's not a very strong and powerful motivator for me. Unfortunately, I think that the inverse is not hold for them. I think they do wake up saying, how do we crush Firefox? And I think that that's reflected in their product. I mean, it's a question of, are you doing this because you want to, or are you doing this because you have to do this financially?
Yeah.
I don't really see this as a battle. I'm sure that i7 will take back some of our market share, and then we're going to take back some of their market share, and I'm sure that we're going to balance out at some point. And I think that the world is better off having two competing browsers.
Oh, I totally agree.
Because it keeps Microsoft honest.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Well, let's talk a little about the development process of the Firefox browser.
Sure.
One of the key differentiators from what you were saying about the older browser with the Netscape side is that, you know, there was a lot of cost involved there, and when you put it out there into an open source community, it basically drops the cost of development, which makes it more competitive with a free offering from the IE browser side of the fence. So what kind of costs have you guys seen happen with the Firefox browser? Has the cost of producing that actually started to grow as your market share has grown? I mean, so how are you guys funding the continuing development and upgrading and distribution of the Firefox browser?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's actually a great question. And as it turns out, I'm sure you've heard the news earlier this year, I guess it was last year, that Mozilla is now technically and legally a for-profit corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
So the structure is that you now have the Mozilla Foundation, which is a non-profit organization, and they kind of own the Mozilla Corporation, which is a for-profit corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for this new structure is because Firefox now has a deal with Google that if you use the search box that's built into Firefox and you click on an ad, some of that revenue goes to Google and some of that revenue goes to Mozilla.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that revenue that goes to Mozilla is pumped back into the organization. And so there have been some reports on the web about how much revenue is being generated by that search deal. You know, I can't speak to that, but I can say it is a lot of money. A lot more is certainly than we're coming in from donations and from the grassroots days a few years ago. We're fortunate enough to be able to have that deal because all of that money, like I said, goes back into funding the product.
That's terrific.
That I'm actually working on a new startup right now.
Well, why don't you give us as much as you can on that project. What are you working on?
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't give you too much on that yet. I'd love to come back in a couple of weeks and tell you guys all about it.
Sure.
But I can say that I'm working with one of the guys that I met at Netscape 6 years ago and started Firefox with. His name is Joe Hewitt. And it's a very large, very ambitious project. I guess the teaser I could give is that if Firefox was the response to Internet Explorer, then what we're working on next is the response to Windows.
Oh, okay. But, well, that sounds like a small project.
Yeah, it's just a, you know, it's a day thing. So.
Yeah, that's true. You went through and talked about the viral marketing kind of practices that you did with the Firefox browser and getting it out there. And now you've got some other websites out there that have kind of spawned from this, like Firefoxies and givefirefox.com. Why don't you kind of talk about some of those websites and how those things are going for you?
Yeah. So Firefoxies and some of the other ones you're probably looking at are actually the result of a project going on right now at Stanford, the new Stanford Design School, which is called the D School.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they've got a couple teams of students there whose project for the quarter is to spread Firefox to as many people as humanly possible. And so these guys are now emailing us every week with just a new idea. They've got a site called SaveGranny.com, which is a cartoon strip about how Firefox saved someone's grandmother from viruses and spyware. They've got so many different efforts coming out. And I think, again, it just speaks to the fact that people feel like they're a part of the success of Firefox and want to share that with others.
Well, now, what's the best way for somebody to get your new book if they want to learn about all these hidden features and functionality that the Firefox browser can do? What's the best way?
It's sold in all the major bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Borders. Of course, you can buy it online and Amazon. I guess the easiest way would be to go to firefoxfordummies.com.
Oh, okay.
That'll redirect you to the Amazon page, and you can buy it there. And I'll be happy to answer any questions about the book or about Firefox. My email address is blake@firefox.com, so that's pretty simple.
And you have a website, I see, at blakeross.com?
BlakeRoss.com.
What are you doing there? Is that a blog, basically, or are you?
Yeah, that's a blog. I update it maybe once a month at this point, hoping to up that a little bit.
Sure. Well, you can always make more posts, right? It just takes more time out of your day.
Right. It's a very difficult thing to write for because I've got so many disparate audiences reading it now. I've got, you know, my school friends, and I've got venture capitalists, and I've got the press. And it's like, how do you write something that is going to appeal to those three audiences.
So you're probably not going to unless you start three different blogs, right?
Exactly.
You're not going to
exactly.
do that. Well, Blake, yeah. thanks for joining me and talking about your new book and kind of the history of Firefox. It's really yeah. interesting to hear it from the inside like this.
Well, this has been great, Rob. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks. We have been speaking with Blake Ross, who's the co-founder of Firefox Web Browser and author of the new Firefox for Dummies book that's available at places like Amazon.com and at his website, BlakeRoss.com. Well, Dana, we're wrapping up another Web Talk Radio show. We hope everybody learned something on this show. I know we had a fun time doing it this week.
I always have fun time with you, Rob, and I've had fun time with all my friends out there. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening and letting us into your lives. We look forward to having you back listening to us next week, next Monday, when we come out with our new show. And go visit our website at webtalkradio.com. If you want to actually slip back in time, once you go to our old site at webtalkguys.com, which is actually a very well-established website online. It's got the highest ranking, and believe it or not, and even though we've had Web Talk Radio out there for years and years, but we'll see you around the net.
That's all the time we have for you tonight. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check out webtalkradio.com for many, many more conversations about the future of the internet.